The Next CMO podcast explores topics that are on the minds of forward-thinking marketing leaders, from vision and strategy to leadership and emerging technologies. The Next CMO is sponsored by Planful, a platform to build, manage, and measure your marketing plan, track all your marketing spend, and connect your budget with outcomes to measure your ROI. Check it out at planful.com/marketing. Your CFO will love you for it. I'm your host, Scott Todaro, a 32-year marketing veteran, 7-time head of marketing, and co-author of the book, The Next CMO. Hello, and welcome to The Next CMO podcast. We have another exciting guest today. We have Jasper Martens, who joins us from PensionBee. He was the, and still is, the CMO over there. 9.5 years he spent. I mean, I think a lot of the CMOs that are going to watch this are going to be pretty impressed. A 9.5 year run, running marketing and being involved in strategic marketing is tough, because there's a lot of evolution over a 9.5 year period at a company. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. Jasper's been doing this for 15 years. He's been doing it primarily in the financial services industry, which is not very easy to do. He's taken this product and he's figured out ways to make it exciting. We're going to talk about that today, because I think this is important for other companies that go to tech companies that may have very technical products that most people don't understand. You can even apply probably a lot of the learnings that he's developed over time, having to try to make products more exciting. And I think it's really important as we start to make an emotional connection with the buyers, and after we've identified those target audiences, to be able to take the products in that direction. So he also worked as the head of marketing communications at Simply Business. I'm going to turn it over to him, but first I just want to talk about what he's going to go through here. He's going to talk about brand, and we've had other discussions on brand, but we've had a lot of B2B discussions. And I think what Jasper is going to do today that's really going to help everybody is to take a little bit of a B2C spin on it. Now, for those of you that are B2B marketers, you can actually learn a lot from B2C. There are a lot of things that you can apply in understanding target audience and getting into the psychographics of identifying what makes people tick. Because at the end of the day, even on B2B, there's still a buyer. There's still a person, they still have emotions, and you still have to connect with them. So I think there's going to be a lot of learnings as he goes through some of the elements of building the brand today. And for those of you that are in financial services, this will be a hand in glove fit. You'll learn a little bit about trust and how to implement trust. And because let's face it, in financial services, if you don't have trust, you really don't have much. All right. So let's jump right into it, Jasper. So thank you so much for joining us today. So my first question to you is, what has been the biggest obstacle in building a direct-to-consumer brand in financial services?
So, yeah, thanks, Scott. I'd say the biggest obstacle with any financial brand, especially when you go direct-to-consumer, is building trust. And whether that was with an insurance product that I used to work before, or now with PensionBee in the UK, and now also in the US. And in the US, we are seeing it now. I can see it already now from the start, because we've just barely gotten started here. Is, would you trust your life savings with a startup? And I wouldn't, but I'm the marketeer, right? So if I don't really trust it, how can I expect my customer to actually take that leap of faith and actually join, sign up for the product? So that's been really, really, and is still really the biggest challenge. And overcoming that and building that trust along the way is hard, but it's absolutely, absolutely possible.
Yeah, trust is absolutely critical to really in almost any brand. But if you're talking about people's children, or you're talking about their money, it's amazing how personal it gets for people pretty quickly. So yeah. That's not surprising. So when you're talking about PensionBee, because you've been there for a while and you had an opportunity to really build up that brand, because I saw that you have like over 260,000 customers now and over 7 billion. So that from basically nothing, it was a startup, right? Yeah. So, you know, how do you build that trust? Like, what are the steps that you looked at and you said, okay, I'm on page one here. And like you said, nobody's going to trust a startup. They've never heard of your brand. And that's where the branding becomes so important in financial services. What was that step-by-step process that you looked at?
I think first of all, if you've got a really good financial solution, a really good product, you always will have some early adopters, some people who might want to take the leap, even if you are just at that starting point of building trust. So your first, say, 100 customers are really important. They will not be your target customer. They will be very good customers to learn from, because they just want to try you out and you want to learn from them. But I do think those people might also be really move on when the other innovation comes along. But you learn enough from them to get started. That insight helps you to understand what maybe holds them back from, you know, not signing up completely. I think that's always been a really good starting point. But with every financial product, what other ways do you got? What other tools in the toolbox have you got to maybe borrow trust or to instantly charge, put trust into your product? So at PensionBee in the UK and now also in the US, we combine your old 401ks into an IRA. So getting financial, get your house in order. Where do you move that money to though? Is that with PensionBee? Or in the case of what we're doing here is our partner State Street Global Advisors. Now, that is a brand name that a lot of Americans might recognize. It's been around for a long time. There's a lot of trust in that brand. So just like we did in the UK, now in the US, that kind of like you borrow another brand's trust and inject it into your own proposition. So the funds are powered by State Street. And suddenly people think, okay, so second part is, so what happens if PensionBee goes bust? I mean, that's a real, not anymore, but especially in the UK days with some seed funding and five people in an office in London, that is definitely a scenario that could play out. Making sure that we had 100% guarantee from the financial services compensation scheme. In other words, if we are going bust, your money is protected. So the authorities will step in. That's guaranteed. So what I've learned from the start with any financial product, whether that's insurance or with now a retirement product, is borrow other brands' trust. Can you do that? Is there an opportunity? And sometimes what's often forgotten, I can see that with many other financial brands, is they've got an amazing solution. Like the app is fantastic. It's sleek. It's like, I want to buy this. But there's always this like voice in your head that said, oh, I'm not sure about this. Like, is this legit? Will they be around? And for many brands, they will work with other brands that have been around for a longer time. So borrow that and use that. Your first customers are usually very, very motivated, and they probably want to talk about that. So, you know, leverage your Trustpilot reviews, use real customers in your advertising. That's what we've did at PensionBee. From the first Facebook ad, from the first radio ad, actually working on testimonials and things. Is it the most creative way of advertising in the early days? You know, can I just put myself in a cannon and being shot out of a stadium? Probably a bit more spectacular. Will it build trust? No. Customer testimonials is a little bit more down to earth. Maybe not the most original way of advertising, but it does build trust. And it's absolutely something I would recommend any financial brand to incorporate into their marketing strategy. Even if you do other things, make sure that that is definitely on point. And I've always gone really big on press, Scott. I don't know if that resonates with you as well, but if you can grab headlines, if you can get journalists, financial influence in our case, to really start reviewing the product, having a bit of an opinion or a bit of they look at it from the outside to your brand, rather than you start to broadcast how great you are, let other people around you start to tell that story about actually what I'm offering is a really good product. And you know, these guys are legit. It looks like a really great solution. So through press and press campaigns, influencer marketing these days, whether if you pick the right ones, absolutely. So it's that kind of like mix you start to build up. I think first, make sure you leverage other people's brands. If you've got that opportunity, activate your customer base, however small that might be from the start, but continue to do so. Even now with our 250,000 customers, we still do it. We still use real customers in our advertising. And you know, let other people tell how great you are rather than tell you doing that job in effect.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And it's funny because I think a lot of B2B companies will invest a lot of money to try to build that brand. in the consumer market, you know, where you're looking, it's a lot better to have a third party endorsement. Yeah. And, you know, one of the other things that you talked about with partnerships there that I think is absolutely critical, and I think a lot of marketing leaders don't think about it, like they feel like when their sales aren't where they need to be, they lean more into acquisition as opposed to, why don't we partner with somebody? Is there an opportunity for a distribution channel? Can we white label something? Is there an opportunity for us to grab somebody else's brand that already has built that trust and build it up? So I think you've covered some key things. Companies that are afraid to do ratings and reviews right now, that's telling you something, right? If you don't feel comfortable with your product, that you're not taking, you know, reviews from like you said, the press or reviews from customers, that can get a little dicey.
Yeah.
And you probably should be spending your time as the head of marketing talking to the product team, saying this is what we need to do in order to make this thing work.
And you know what I like about reviews? I like one-star reviews as well. Just as much as I like five stars, I really love one-star reviews because, you know, a brand will make mistakes. A company will make mistakes. And it's the way you address those mistakes and listen to those customers and address their grievances, because you're not going online and leave a one-star review. So if you do, there's clearly something gone wrong. It's the way you address that and kind of develop that, either solve that for the customer, but also incorporate some learnings into the product. We've had some terrible one-star reviews in the past when it came to taking money out of your time and product, and that it didn't go as smoothly as it was intended. The product then improved. We got back to those customers. Then they will kind of come back and say, this is fantastic. So you can turn things around. So for anybody who's afraid, so first of all, if your product is not in a good state and you don't trust your product enough to leave reviews in the first place, yeah, that's got to be addressed by product improvements. But when you are comfortable, don't be afraid to see some of these one-star reviews incoming. It's actually a good thing. Can you imagine as a consumer, if I would look at a Trustpilot page and the only thing I see is five-star reviews and it's, you know, ProDent Toothpaste White reviews, that's not really trustworthy, is it? Like, something's got to go wrong at some times. So it's the way a company then addresses those reviews. That's actually building trust.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm not saying, guys, leave all one-star reviews now tomorrow. calm down. But I'd say I do like to receive them. I do read all of our customer reviews. And we do action those.
Hey, you bring up some good points. And I want heads of marketing that are watching this to fully understand the one-star review. People forget that product is part of the four P's of marketing, right? And your responsibility as the head of marketing is to look at the market. What is the market telling you? And I have seen too many CMOs these days that are leaning too far into what is their sales team saying that's happening in the marketplace. Having run sales four times, if you ask a salesperson, you know, what's going on, they're going to tell you the last customer they talked to, and you're not going to get the right perspective on things. This is an opportunity to take that one-star review, understand why it was a one-star review, and then bring that back to the company. That will give you greater power in helping to shape the product, because at the end of the day, you can be a tremendous marketer, but if the product doesn't deliver, eventually it will drag you down. You can't market yourself for long periods of time with a subpar product. And so if you want to be successful on the marketing side, you need to build that momentum, learn from it, bring that back to the company, and make sure that the product is getting fixed. That's your responsibility. And I think a lot of marketers forget that because they're so busy with acquisition. Okay, you've been doing this a long time. You have a journey. You got a journey in financial services. Tell us a little bit about the journey. People always love to hear the human element of this.
I'd say, you know, being a marketer for retirement solution was not on my career path projection when I was in my 20s. So I'm Dutch, grew up in the Netherlands, got my bachelor in marketing and my master in marketing communication. So pretty much kind of like I knew I was going to do something in communications, public relations, marketing, or whatever sorts. I had various roles in Amsterdam, where I used to live, especially out of university. But actually, the big kind of move into financial services accidentally happened when I moved to London from Amsterdam. That wasn't a career decision. That was kind of a personal decision, a.k.a. my partner is British, and therefore we decided to uproot our stuff in Amsterdam and move to London. And my path at the time was very much digital marketing, search engine optimization. It's something you didn't teach for, but it's something that really interested me in terms of how can you create content that will rank well, that customers really want to engage with, and therefore you drive traffic to the website. That's kind of a bit of my geeky side that really interested me. Joined an insurance company in London, which is called Simply Business. Joined them as an SEO executive in 2009, when there were 50,000 customers. And then because that company was growing a lot, and I really started to understand from really good people there as well, and upscaling myself around, wow, how do you make something so boring as business insurance, professional indemnity insurance, public liability insurance, engaging for a small business owner? Left that company when it hit 300,000 customers in 2015 as a head of marketing. And then, of course, moved to PensionBee, a company that was just founded, had two co-founders, had some seed capital, a very enthusiastic CEO, Romy Savova. And my recruiter warned me, this is very early stage. Are you ready for this? And I said, how early stage? There is no line of code written, Jasper. So this is just an idea on paper. And I said, okay, this is interesting. Let me go anyway. Within 5 minutes, I came back from that in that conversation. I was like, wow, I should have come up with this idea. The fact that she was trying to solve something in the UK market with regards to people who move jobs all the time, don't know where their pensions are, like we all do, right? Or in the US, it's not pensions, it's your 401k. It's slightly different. But you move jobs, you leave your 401k behind, you might lose track of them, you don't know what's in them, etc. And it's life admin. And it's very sometimes difficult to get this all in one place. I was like, wow, I should have come up with this idea, but she did now. I might as well join. So I joined as their first employee in 2015. With five people in the room. And from that moment onwards, it was really building that product, understanding the problem of the customer and building that out. So fast forward now a few years, that we started to get traction in the UK. I really learned in marketing to go from purely from digital activations, acquisition campaigns, take some of the learnings from Simply Business and apply them to this pension brand where, you know, how do I build trust, but also create an emotion that comes with actually getting all of your life admin or your financial life admin sorted. And that led us to our first brand campaign, television campaign. Suddenly I was in the middle of a television shoot that took multiple days and in football, in soccer stadiums and road closures. And I'm like, okay, where are we now? The IPO, so we IPO'd, we became a public company on the London Stock Exchange in 2021. Suddenly there was extra marketing funding available and all eyes were suddenly pointed on me. Jasper, how are you going to spend this now? So suddenly the marketing budget went to, well, around $22 million. And I was, and the question then is, how are you going to spend this wisely? So this was a really interesting position to be in. I kind of knew how to spend it. But still, it's quite a bit of a responsibility to then to apply the money in the right way, on the right activities, build your team, scale your team. So it's been a journey. And that's why I'm also still there. It's you a CMO tenure probably is around 3 years. I've been there now 9.5 years. The only reason as a CMO you want to stay there for 9.5 years if you go to work and there's something new to do. Like, you can't just sit there and be stationary. Like, I would have got bored really quickly. But from the moment we acquired our first customer to now our 250,000 customer in the UK, plus now just moved to New York to lead on the marketing expansion here in the US, Scott, we've got 50 customers or so at the moment. It's like, it's really early days. But that really kind of helps me to ensure that building a team here and building out the proposition, there's something new to explore. So I do feel for every CMO or my head of marketing who is in a particular position, as long as there's something new to explore, something new to do, and you feel that fire burning, absolutely stay. There's no shame to be there longer than 3 years. But when that's done, then you do probably need to think about what's next.
Yeah, that's a great story that you just went through because, you know, frankly, when you just said that you joined the company as a marketer without a product, That's tough, right? I mean, what do you do all day? I mean, you're gonna like, I guess you're writing and preparing for a product to actually be launched, and you need to do the launching of it. But you know, if you're there a little too early, you know, it can get a little scary. Like, what are you doing today? Like, I don't know. I already built a website. I've already got. That's fascinating.
It's also very. I think one of the things I've learned there is, if you join a founding team, because that's what it was. You do actually do a bit of HTML. You do actually write a press release. You do go for a coffee with a finance editor of the Daily Telegraph. You do all of these things in a particular day. I found it very scary because you are very exposed. You think you know everything, but marketing is a very fast-changing profession. So you've got to be that sponge and soak up all of the new stuff that's coming your way. And when I joined PensionBee from Simply Business, the Meta campaigns, aka Instagram and Facebook campaigns, is something we really didn't do at Simply Business. And suddenly there I was uploading a video that I shot on an iPhone and advertising that on Facebook just to see if there was a good CPA running on that campaign. I mean, that's as basic and as kind of underground you can get. And it's humble. Leave your ego at the front door, I would say, if you're in that situation. I think a lot of people like the sound of joining a startup, like especially in 2015, there was a big boom in London with fake companies like Revolut, TransferWise, Monzo, all of these big neo banks, fintechs, all of the hype was there, the funding was there. And a lot of people thought, I'm in a very big incumbent company, let's just join that company from the start. How great is that? Well, the thing is, it sounds all very sexy on paper, but just sit there on your chair on a Monday morning and you think, okay, press release, Facebook campaign, meet this person, website copy, etc. Your CEO correcting your press release because I'm not a native English speaker, but I had to do a press release. So, you know, some basic English grammar. You will be very humble after the first week. And I think it's been a really great learning for me. And the interesting bit about this is you go from that early stage. And then you go into now a public company where there is an annual capital markets day, there are quarterly results, and it's suddenly very much like tie on, suit on kind of affair sometimes, and engaging with shareholders. Not everybody can do that. I was not sure I was able to do that myself. But because I was so tied to the product, the solution, and I got still triggered to discover something new in the brand and really build that brand from scratch, I think I've been able to transform into it most of the time, but it's a challenge.
Yeah, it's an incredible challenge. And, you know, the interesting thing, like you said, you're going from like a budget of almost nothing, you know, overnight you go public, you got $22 million. I was going to ask you how you spend that $22 million, but one of the things that you brought up to me is that you guys actually sponsor the Premier League Soccer. So I'm assuming that a lot of it goes to that. Now, you're going to have to tell us exactly how in God's green earth you got your management team to agree to sponsor Premier League Soccer. Because the sponsorship, obviously, great brand awareness. It can create credibility. But, you know, let's face it. You have to have a lot of money to burn, and you've got to have a board that really understands marketing. So.
Yes. So first, zoom out. Don't worry. Not the big chunk of marketing budget goes to this particular thing. I think when it comes to sports sponsorships, my rule of thumb is usually 10 to 15% of your annual budget max should be spent on upper funnel brand activity like this. So you've got enough other budget left for other initiatives, either upper funnel, mid funnel, or lower funnel activities. However, why would a retirement company sponsor a soccer club? A Premier League soccer club. Long story short, this was in the time where the marketing budget did went up. We were doing out-of-home campaigns, billboards, radio, regular TV, on-demand TV, lots of upper funnel activities, building reach, building brand awareness, start building that upper funnel activity. And I got in touch with Brentford. As they got in touch with me, we had this conversation, and, you know, cut a long story short, we started with a relatively small activity where we would just have these, you know, these LEDs around the football pitch, where that would be shown for a few minutes. And what you can do with football is you can measure the impact. You think, how do you do that? Well, there's a couple of ways to look at this. First of all, I had a relatively small investment initially for one season to see how our attachment to, in this case, Brentford, the Brentford Bees, Pension B, Brentford Bees, nice attachment, right? London Football Club. How would that kind of like, how would that work? Well, first of all, you can actually measure the media value you derive from a sports sponsorship. There are pretty good measuring tools in the UK. You've got YouGov, a sports monitor, who will calculate every time your logo appears in the press, every time it appears online, how many minutes your boards were visible during the television broadcast, how many people were watching that. It calculates a value to that. Now, that means that for every pound I spend on that sports sponsorship, I get a return. In our case, it turned out to be, because Brentford was going up really from Championship to the highest tier, Premier League, suddenly we were putting £1 in, we're getting £7 to £8 back in media value. Now, benchmark that against how much do I spend on radio versus how much value I get back from radio in terms of returns. Sometimes radio overdelivers 20 to 30%. Because you just get a little bit more listens than anticipated and so forth. But with the sports sponsorship, £1 turns into £7 to £8. I think that was pretty darn good value. So you need to then benchmark that brand channel versus some of the other brand channels you do. Bear in mind, doing a sport match, you don't have 30 seconds to explain what you do. It's just going to be a logo. So it's that kind of higher upper funnel activity. So that's one way to look at it. Can you benchmark it against other brand channels? What's the media value you derive from your investment you make? The second part was, I could clearly see it from our prompted brand awareness survey. So 4 times a year, we measure that. Premier League football is over-indexed on men, predominantly in the UK. And for the first time, I could see the lines starting to fall apart. I could see that actually amongst men, brand awareness was growing faster than amongst women. Got to fix that, of course. But it was really good to see that trend going up, because then it does mean that people start to understand who you are. And then the third thing, we did some really great direct activations with the club. So you are able to engage with the actual fan base. And if the hook, how you advertise is great with them, you actually get customers through the door. So cut a long story short, purely from a direct activation, I got the board on board quite quickly because I could see a direct correlation. But after that, I was able to update on some of the more high brand metrics, such as prompted brand awareness, such as the media value, such as all of these data points, to understand actually this is a really good way to advertise. Instead of putting that money onto a billboard that sits along highways that people might see for a split second, actually 8 minutes in-game banners having a logo on the shirt might actually be a much better call. So that's how it came about. And once you start to see those results coming into your dashboards, and you can report back, management team is on board. And I think that's also another key learning for me on this particular activity. We started small. We saw you've got the right data points. You see an impact. You have much more confidence than to scale up. And we're now one of their main sponsors. So it's starting small and then scale it up once you see traction, and then you can really start to see that impact. Second, as a marketer, you need to talk spreadsheets, Scott. Like most people in management teams or boards are not marketers. So the best way to convince them that something is clearly doing a great job and it's working is if you can translate all of your activity in cold, hard numbers. It's the area most marketers dread the most. It's not the area that most marketers didn't choose a career to produce spreadsheets. That's not what they want to do. That's not why they do the job. But in order to get the board on board, or the management team on board, and to get the budgets you need to be successful, you got to talk spreadsheets. And that's the second part of this whole activity. You've developed that skill set.
Yeah, without a doubt, I completely agree with that. And, you know, in the book, The Next CMO that we wrote, you know, we delve pretty deeply into ROI. And, You know, the sad thing is that when I talk to marketers, because I CMO coach quite a few, they're not calculating ROI. And people are like, well, I don't have time to do it. And I sat there going, well, how do you know whether it's working or not? It's like playing a soccer game. Let's use the analogy here. It's like playing a soccer game, and we're just going to track the number of passes that are made back and forth, not whether the ball goes in the net or whether you won the game, right? We can track activity and lead generation, but what is that really translating into ROI for the business? And it has to be trackable. Otherwise, you're just doing stuff for the sake of doing it. You're doing empty calorie marketing, and it's not going to really result in anything that's going to make a huge impact. All right. So one of the things that I always love to talk about in these, and I think you are agreeable on this, is, you know, what do you think, what skills do you think are really important? You know, when you're in a startup environment that make a great CMO, or that just you need to have to be able to survive. Because I think that some CMOs that are new at this are really struggling. They're trying to make the head of sales happy by getting a bunch of leads, but is that really the full skill set that you need in order to be successful? What have you found, Jasper?
Two main things that help you to survive past the 6 month point or the 1 year point at a startup, but generally in companies. I think having a very deep understanding for who you're doing it for. Don't get carried away by lots of initiatives in the company, but actually, what's your target customer? What's your ideal customer? What does that customer look like? What are their needs? Just really understanding. It sounds very bland and very, you know, obvious. You will be surprised how many marketers I have no idea who they're marketing. They just, it's like Teflon. They just stick something against the wall and hopefully they hope it sticks. And that doesn't, in retirement, that's not going to work. For example, somebody who is 52 will have a complete different mindset in terms of what they think retirement should look like and what their needs are for a particular product than somebody who's 29. So when you're 29 as a marketer, you can create great ads that you think are great, but is that 52-year-old person, which is your target customer, really going to be, you know, exposed that really think that you are the great product to go for? So understanding your customer is your first thing. Listen to customers, having conversation with customers. I still enjoy that a lot. And it makes you very humble because you often still get it wrong. So you will be able to stay corrected once you spoke to them and you analyze that. So I think that's one. Second is not just tell the lead gen story, tell the bigger story in terms of what that means for the product and the brand in the long term. So my dashboards that I look at on a daily basis, which again, you know, become a bit of a data nerd. It's not what PR marketing is about, but you've got to be a bit of a data nerd. During COVID, we had some opportunities to actually build a data platform capabilities ourselves rather than getting an off-the-shelf solution where we could tie behavioral data and channel data together and being able to see what touch points your customers will actually make to not just onboard, but to also engage with it post-onboarding. So metrics such as, okay, your CPA, how much does it cost to acquire that customer? But also, what's the value of that customer? Is their retirement account growing over time? Do they start adding more money in? Those are all points that you, and then you can start to tell that story. So my average age of the customer is this. These are my core segments that are our target customers. This was their initial CPA. This is their lifetime value. This is our retention rate on those customers. Once you start telling that story and the board and the management team thinks, okay, we've actually got those numbers. He clearly knows the customer. He clearly knows what's driving value in the company. Gets you to a point where you not only, they don't want to get rid of you because you clearly got those two things right. I'm now in a position, I'm actually quite good relationships with our CFO. Now, normally CMOs and CFOs, there's a tension going on. Like CFOs do not want to get the money. CMOs always want more money to grow faster. We've gotten in a situation now where the CFO will, on a regular basis, just have a conversation with me and says, we've actually, you know, company's doing better than expected. If you would have an extra X amount, would you be able to spend that wisely in this current year? And that is a great position to be in. But of course, he's looking at the bigger picture. He's not looking at the short-term injection of cash and how many leads leads we're getting, he looks at what does do those leads convert into customers? What will be the average retirement account? What will be their retention rate? What's the ads and so forth? And that is the second part. So aside from knowing your customer inside out, telling that bigger story, looking back at your historical data, but also being able to project what's to come by having those data points in mind. And that means, as a marketeer, you can't just rely on the data analyst in your team or somebody outside of the marketing team to produce a great dashboard for you. You might not have to build it from scratch, but you need to have an understanding where the data is coming from and how these things work and how databases are probably connected, where those data points are coming from. I think that those two things for me are important to survive. I'd say a third point, we can maybe talk about it a bit later, but the third point for me is if you understand the customer deeply, what drives them to use the product and move away from, you've got a problem, I've got a solution, here's a nice new shiny new app to download. Actually, how does that product make you feel rather than just focusing on solving the problem for your target customer? It's around, how does it make you feel? In our case, getting on top of all your old 401ks brings a massive sense of relief. So that emotion that you get when you are finally on top of your finances, that's what I'm giving you. I'm not just giving you an app. That's what I'm giving you. So again, understanding what emotional layers you can bring to a product, especially in financial services, I think it's a third skill set almost, that will help you to stay longer than a few months.
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring up the time frame and you brought up the target audience. I can't tell you how many marketers, like you pointed out, that don't actually sit down with customers. There are two things that I don't know why this is a lost skill, but when I came out of college a long time ago, we ran surveys and focus groups all the time. No one does them anymore. I don't understand why we just skip to feeling like we know everything. You got to be able to pull that data in. So I think your target audience evaluation and understanding is absolutely critical. The metrics you talk about and being able to measure are also absolutely critical. But here's one thing that I will add to that is that marketers need to start with a set of goals. I can't tell you how many plans I have seen. No goals. A bunch of stuff you're going to do, but like, why are you doing this? Like, what are the company goals? How does marketing help achieve those goals? Because it's funny, if you look at the company goals, usually 60 to 100% of them, marketing has a role in helping achieve. Just start there. Start with the goals, understand the target audience. Like you said, understand the product you're selling in context with the target audience. And then last, take those goals and set some sort of metric achievement so that you can actually go to the board and go to the executive team and say, this is what we achieved. And it's downstream enough, they're business related metrics that everybody understands and they have the confidence that you're doing right. And then you make it 9.5 years in a job as opposed to 6 months. Now, I will say one other thing about the 6 months. Don't ever, when you take your job, I don't care whether you're on B2B or B2C, don't ever tell the CEO that you're gonna turn this thing around in 6 months, because you will not. You will not. No. You need to say 6 months, you will start to see some traction at that point. And you need to take 2 months and do an audit of the business, that includes customers, before you make any decisions. Okay? A lot of marketers come in like we need leads. And then all of a sudden, before you know it, you're running around trying to do these leads. All right, last question for you, Jasper. If you had one piece of advice to give CMOs or aspiring CMOs, what would that piece of advice be?
For me, that is dare to take risk for when you seek a new opportunity. So don't easily think, I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure if I can do this. Chances are you actually can. Maybe it sounds a little bit like, I'm fantastic. I'm perfect. No, you're not. You will make mistakes. For me, moving from a more well-established company to like a really early stage startup was a massive risk. But I think you've got to take risks in your career in order to get somewhere where you want to be. So I'd say don't just play it safe when it comes to career changes. And dare to dive into the deep and be that sponge and soak up all of that marketing knowledge, because you don't know everything. Marketing is changing way too fast. People are throwing stuff at us all the time. It's the way you learn and soak things up and then execute is what makes you successful. So yeah, do take that risk, take the deep end, as long as you be that sponge.
Absolutely. Can't agree with you more, having taken a bunch of risks myself. It's scary, but why not be scared a little bit in your life? I mean, we go watch horror movies. Why? There's no difference.
Yeah.
Jasper, thank you so much for your time today. It's been wonderful speaking to you. For those of you in the podcast, go to the community, thenextcmo.com, and you can go watch other podcasts that we have set up there. Tons and tons of information, templates to help you do your job, all free to help you get through the process of building out your plan, building out your budget, calculating the ROI on your marketing. We want you to be successful. So stay tuned to other episodes. And Jasper, thanks. Hopefully we'll see you on another episode at some point. Good luck.
Nice to be here, Scott. Thank you.